You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, brought to you by iWoka, flexible loans built for small businesses, iwoka.co.uk. Today, we're in Sarah Gorez.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in Clermont-Ferrand, the capital of the Massif Central. Would that be accurate, François?
I think you could say that, yeah, absolutely.
It's a big town. I think we've been quite surprised by the kind of the metropolitan urban feel to Clermont-Ferrand. I thought it was a bit of an industrial backwater, but it doesn't feel like that at all.
Well, it used to be the town of Michelin for, you know, the tires, for the good and the bad. I mean, the good being maybe the Michelin guide, which, you know, helps us from time to time find the right places to eat. And the downside in some ways, while the tire industry was almost a mono industry in Clermont-Ferrand, and I think the town suffered a little bit when Michelin was not, you know, well, like every kind of city in industrial decline. But yeah, it's almost the only big city in all of Auvergne and the Massif Central, even though you have Le Puy-en-Velay a little bit more north. And so yeah, universities are here. Some of the local authorities and powers are here as well. So yeah, there is that feel that you're in as you say, metropolitan.
Pardon my ignorance, but is Michelin still here?
Yeah, Michelin's still here. Yeah, absolutely.
It feels very modern and lots of young people. It's a city that kind of sits in a basin, isn't it?
With the Puy de Dôme. I mean, you know, legendary Puy de Dôme for Tour de France fans. Really overlooking the. You can see the Puy de Dôme almost from every spot when you're in Clermont-Ferrand. It's pretty near.
We're going to go and ride up the Puy de Dôme.
Well, I don't know about that. But let's deal with the Puy de Dôme, because we always get asked this. It's one of the legendary climbs of the Tour de France. It's where the famous picture of Raymond Poulidor and Jacques Anquetil going shoulder to shoulder. I think Poulidor was trying to avoid a selfie stick, which is why he leaned into Anquetil in 1964.
Topical. Bringing it right up to date there, Lionel.
It's brilliant. Also where Eddie Merckx was punched in the side, mm-hmm. and in 1975.
Yeah, they didn't need selfie sticks at the day. It just, you know, went straight at the riders.
Arguably bringing his reign to a close, really. I mean, was he going to win that tour? No, wasn't. But it was a big moment.
Yeah, it was one of the big moments. I mean, he claimed that it really hampered him. I mean, in that tour, he fought like every day. I mean, he didn't bow without a fight. He was Merckx, throughout. He was grand in defeat. As grand as it'd been in victory. So, but as you said, that was one of the signs of his decline for sure.
And you see the Puy de Dôme from so far away, and especially when you come down into town, it's a real conical, it's tree-covered, isn't it? And there's some kind of antenna on the top. Mm-hmm. The last time the Tour de France visited was in 1988, and Johnny Welts won the stage ahead of Rolf Goltz of Germany. They were the two that got away. Johnny Welts of Denmark won, but the Tour hasn't been back. And François, why not? And is it likely that the Tour could visit Puy de Dôme?
I know that Christian Prudhomme has been asking almost every year for the rights to exceptionally go up the Puy de Dôme, because it's close to cars now. You can ride to it only very occasionally. They're really trying to protect the It was so emblematic in France, and it had become so touristy. And we like all the puits in the, because this is, you know, these are all volcanoes that actually surround Clermont-Ferrand, and there are so many visits to those places that, you know, that they're actually becoming endangered. And so for lack of the Puy de Dôme, I mean, they really refuse still now, you know, to have a cycling race to the top. I know Prud'homme will press on and press on and press on to get it, but for lack of the Puy-de-Dôme, we'll have Puy-Marie on Friday, because it's actually the Puy-Marie is even higher than Puy-de-Dôme and has become, you know, it kind of replaced Puy-de-Dôme in you know, for tourists as a place to go and a place to be. And so I guess Puy-Marie could, we'll see on Friday, but could become an interesting substitute or replacement for the Puy-de-Dôme.
There's a rack railway that mm-hmm. goes up yep. now, isn't there? Has that mm-hmm. narrowed the road at all? Do you know?
I think the road is still exists. Still exists. I mean, I haven't been up there for many years, but I my impression is that it narrowed the road quite a bit. I think they're not making any effort to allow cars up there. So I think it's if Prud'homme has been asking for a race to go there, I think the road is still you know, practicable enough to stage a race. But so far it's been a no, and the answer has been no every year.
If he manages it, will we be able to call him Christian Puy-de-Dôme?
Oh, well, he's Christian Prude at home at the moment, as somebody said on some kind of social media outlet.
Mustn't laugh. Our colleague
Max Leonard, who writes lovely books about cycling and who featured in our Kilometre Zero episode on the writer Tim Crabbe's book, he wrote up the Puy-de-Dôme quite recently for one of his books, Higher Calling, about climbing mountains. And he did so by probably illegally or semi-illegally going up very early in the morning, which is a sort of pilgrimage that some people make, and if you want to read about what it's like to ride up the Puy-de-Dôme now, then you can read about it in his book. What a thrilling stage we had today.
Amazing.
The longest stage of the race, and something a bit different. I love stages like today's. We've been singing the praises of Team Sunweb, I think, for their attempts every day pretty much to try and win the stage, often with a different rider, with different tactics, different strategies.
Lionel even claimed that they were the best team in the first week, which was disputable, and is now vindicated in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. They're a team that came here just for stage wins, it's been good to watch them go about it in a slightly different way every day. And I think, you know, again, we benefit enormously from the insights of Nikias Arndt, who's their road captain and one of our audio diarists, who sends us in little audio clips, which you'll have heard in a lot of the episodes. We've got more. There'll be more to come in tomorrow's Kilometre Zero, I think. But it's fascinating to get that insight from inside the team, and you really get a sense from that of what it is they're trying to do and how they do it and the process behind it.
Just to be fair, I was referring to kind of like looking at the names on the roster and the impact that they had in the race. They were clearly punching above their pre-race weight, I felt.
And they have three guys in the top 10 today, which shows, you know, what a team. Well, actually, that Mark Hirsch's win was also a team effort, obviously.
Well, stage 12, Chauvigny to Sarin-Corrèze, Jacques Chirac's territory,
hometown, you can say. He had a castle there.
Yeah, there was a lot of Jacques Chirac in evidence on the route today, wasn't there? Mm. All kinds of Jacques Chirac art.
Yeah, there was a huge Jacques Chirac picture made of agricultural products in a field, in a huge field, and he's hugely popular in the area. And you know, like many celebrities, even politicians, people tend to like them better when they're gone than when they were still alive. But in that area, you know, Chirac was like God. I mean, there's a museum in Sarran to his name. It's not actually a museum about Jacques Chirac. He actually put in this museum all the gifts he received in his career as a French president. So, you know, every time he was going abroad to some official visit, you know, you get some strange dish or sometimes a horse or very different. Well, I don't think the horse is in the museum, but anyways, so all this stuff he collected are collected in the museum, and of course there are pictures and memories of. He's still hugely popular in the area, and he was a strange president because he was actually popular in the area for left wing and right wing as well. He was, when he left power, the politics in France became much more divisive. I guess it's probably a trait of every nation, but he was probably the last French president who had some popularity, to be honest.
Well, you've got a Jacques Chirac story that I hope we'll hear later in the episode, yeah, Francois.
We'll finish off with the Jacques Chirac story.
It was also
Chirac
the Raymond Poulidor stage as well, wasn't it, today?
It was, yeah. Well, Jacques Chirac died last September. Raymond Poulidor died last November. And it was the Raymond Poulidor stage because it went through his hometown, Saint-Léonard-de-Noblat. And, today's stage 12 from Chauvigny to Sarancolles, was a lesson that if at first you don't succeed, try and try again. And it was third time lucky. And I can't really use the word lucky for Mark Hershey because, you know, he made it happen for himself, was very, very aggressive, and is the first Swiss stage winner in the Tour de France since his mentor, Spartacus himself, Fabian Cancellara, who won the prologue in Liège in 2012. Francois has nicknamed Mark Hershey of Sunweb Baby Spartacus, and well, he rode like, it was swashbuckling, it was aggressive, it was everything that we saw on the road into Nice when he was picked by Julian Alaphilippe, everything we saw again in the Pyrenees when he was beaten by Tadej Pogacar, but this time he's taken his first Tour de France stage in his first Tour de France, and it was a real action-packed day. We'll talk about how these days kind of have so much more life to them when the GC isn't done and dusted. I don't know why that is, but certainly you feel a lot more of that. It didn't feel like a sort of consolation stage at all. It felt like anything could happen out there. There are loads of action all day, a very powerful break right from the start. Richard, you described it as a kind of rugby front row going off in an attack. Emmanuel Eviti of Movistar, Max Valscheid of NTT, the Spanish champion Luis Leon Sanchez of Astana, and Niels Pollitt of Israel, and then Mathieu Bougadou of Direct Energy, Total Direct Energy, and Kasper Asklin of De Koenig Quickstep bridged across. And that set...
It's actually the largest break in Tour de France history.
In by weight?
Weight and height.
Is that right?
Check that out, Killian Kelly, if you're listening.
I think if you put them end to end, they reach the moon or the top of the Puy de Dôme. I don't know. One or the other. It meant that Bora Hansgrohe, with a bit of help from CCC, were in for a really hard chase all day. Eventually, the last two men standing were Asgreen and Eviti. They were brought back in to under control inside 50 to go. And then there was another break, I mean, even more powerful. At three Sunweb, as you say, Francois, were in there. Hershey, Thijs Benoot and Søren Krau Andersen, plus Max Schachmann of Bora, Marc Soler of Movistar, Quentin Pachet of B&B Hotels, or B&B Hotel.
B&B.
If we're going with the French. Mark Hershey went clear with 30 kilometres to go and solo to a very, very impressive victory. And although there was a suspense in the Pyrenees, we felt he had a better than even chance of making it. Today, I didn't feel there was any doubt. Watching the way he climbed, watching the way he descended, there was a lot of action behind, especially from Julian Alaphilippe. But Hershey held on, won the stage in super impressive style. Pierre Roland of B&B Hotels will pretty pleased with the second place tonight. And Søren Krau Andersen of Sunweb made it two men in the top three today. All the jerseys stay the same. A hard day for everyone, but the GC riders didn't want to get involved in doing too much because tomorrow it's the summit finish at Puy-Marie, and it will be, well, the people we've spoken to in around the team bus paddock informally expect tomorrow to be quite aggressive from the GC riders. It could be one of those days. But there we are, Mark Hershey, a stage winner in the Tour.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWoka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWoka. If you run a small business, find out more at iwoka.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to iWoka for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Over the past months, we've heard from some of iWoka's customers, and we'll hear from some more customers again in future episodes about the service that iWoka offers. Basically, they offer loans, but they're not a bank. They're an independent company, custom built to help small businesses. And what that means is that they work closely with the small business, and they make a real effort to get to learn the nuances of that small businesses, understand things like seasonal rises and falls in trade, come to understand when a small business needs to make significant outlay to invest in something, whether that be equipment or staff for their future. And so it's not just asking a bank for a loan and getting an answer generated by a computer. It's actually a conversation between people. And so iWOCA is able to help a lot of small businesses, and in fact has lent money to over 50,000 small businesses since 2012, some of whom are quite big names. And, Trustpilot, from more than 4,400 reviews, give them a very high sort of 4.75 stars out of 5 on the old Trustpilot. So if you want to find out more about iWOCA, if you run a small business and you'd like some finance for any reason to help grow your business, go to iwoca.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk.
Well, today was all about Mark Hershey, wasn't it, really, and Team Sunweb. It was a stage that we thought was going to be one for a big breakaway. Thomas de Gendt was a rider that people were talking about.
Greg Van Avermaet. I talked to him in the morning, thinking he might be there. And obviously CCC were trying to send someone up front, maybe the Marquee. But, I mean, Greg Van Avermaet was nowhere to be seen, unfortunately.
Well, it was... Yeah, I mean, there was a big breakaway of big riders, but they were never allowed too much time, and we saw a lot of work on the front from Bora Hansgrohe and CCC, and we sort of assumed that Bora Hansgrohe were working for Peter Sagan, especially after his disappointment of being relegated the previous day for using his head to move Wout van Aert. Still lots of debate and discussion about that, I think. It was the right decision. You can't use your head like that. Even if there is an obstacle, a selfie stick in your way, I really don't think that was a factor in Sagan using his head to try and move Wout van Aert out of the way.
Yeah, let's deal with that first before we move on to today's stage. Because, one team manager I spoke to today suggested that Sagan should have been disqualified from the Tour entirely for that. And... when you think back to the incident a few years ago with Mark Cavendish, Sagan was kicked out of the Tour. I think that maybe would have been a bit too strong, but Sagan...
Had Wout van Aert crash, Wout van Aert is a very skillful bike handler. I mean, something we didn't really touch on, I suppose, last night was, watching that, anyone who's ridden a bike watches that, and at the speed they were going... out the saddle, somebody makes contact with you. Just the ability to stay upright in that scenario is quite impressive. And Wout van Aert is obviously a fantastic bike handler, but a lesser bike handler may well have at that moment crashed. I mean, the handlebars are very close together. Sagan was kind of coming up behind them, and that's what happened with Cavendish. The handlebars got sort of caught together, and. Yeah, it was a dangerous manoeuvre, and we shouldn't really judge these things by their outcomes, because it could have caused a terrible crash, and a lesser crime, if you want to call it that, may also have caused a terrible crash. We can't really judge these things by the outcome; it's the manoeuvre itself, and I think. Sagan's was very, very dangerous.
Well, I think the assumption Sagan makes is that everyone's as gifted a bike handler as he is.
That's
and they're not necessarily. Van Aert clearly is. But, I mean, it's just the whole premise of whether or not you should move your head in a sprint. And there's no excuse for that. So... but it was interesting to hear a team manager suggest that Sagan could have been kicked out of the race rather than just relegated for that move. But you're right. Today, perhaps he did feel like he wanted to make amends. I mean, he did win, or he did get some points at the finish line to sort of narrow the gap a little bit on Sam Bennett, or at least not let the gap open up anymore. But whether or not they were confident that Sagan would get over that final climb to the finish. I don't know. It looked a bit much when they were climbing
from
it.
From our diarist, Lucas Postelberger, who was very visible again today, did a lot of work, and he'll be able to tell us what the thinking was. I mean, in the end, Max Schachmann was up there, and it was a good stage for him, and he's obviously riding better. And I don't know whether he was plan B or plan A today. I don't think anybody could really beat Hirschi, but Schachmann rode pretty well, and probably given where he's coming from with the broken collarbone that he suffered before the race, probably quite happy.
The last cycling race I saw, obviously for lockdown, was Paris-Nice, and I got locked down the day after Paris-Nice, and Schachmann at that time of the season was absolutely brilliant, and you could tell what you know, the more than potential, what a force he could be even in the Grand Tour. I mean, like many riders, he crashed. You know, coming into the Tour de France with the nervousness of the released, the freed peloton. It's a bit unfortunate for him to have ridden the Tour, you know, half of the Tour, with still probably feeling the pain from his collarbone fracture. As you say, he looked much better today. He didn't finish far. And we're kind of hoping, you know, he has a third week, because he's an incredible talent. He's a great all-rounder. And my impression, to answer your question, was that the plan, at least in the finale, was all for Schachmann, pretty much more than for Sagan. Because let's face it, now with the deficit he's got towards Bennett, it'll be super hard for Sagan, unless he shines in the Alps, to make up for lost time. So I won't come back personally on the sprint, yesterday's sprint, because as I said yesterday, I don't like you have endless discussions about, you know, refereeing in every sport, and my rule has always been that, you know, I suppose commissaires know more about the sport than I do. They have more documents to analyze, more videos, more everything, more, well, you know, testimonies to study, and in the end, the decision they made was probably the right one.
Mark Hirschi, though, I mean, you know, not just today, and not just the Pyrenees, but in Nice as well. He's been one of the most consistent riders to get up there to try and win a stage, and it happened for him finally, I suppose, today. He's a very impressive looking rider. He looks very, once he gets away, I mean, he was away for 90 kilometres at the weekend. Today it was
30
kilometres. Yeah. Still quite a long way to go, and with some strong chasers, but helped by having teammates behind, no doubt. You know, Teish Banoot did a great job to set him up for the attack. Once he got away, I don't know whether he's a good time trialist, I must admit, but he looks very aero. His bike looks very aero. He's got quite narrow handlebars, and I've thought, you know, Sunday and today, he's looked good in that, you know, once he's away and he's time trialing to the finish, he looks very, very strong indeed. And I don't really know what kind of rider he could become. He's the right build to be good on the climbs, good on the longer climbs. We obviously saw him on Sunday looking good on the longer climbs. Who knows what he can become?
Well, he's had a go on three hilly stages to one degree or another, and the bottom of that last climb was steep, wasn't it? But you can't say that his victory didn't owe an awful lot to the way Sunweb rode in that final 50 kilometres. I mean, Nico Roach was active at one point, and then they got three riders in that break. I mean, when you look, again, I keep saying it, but there are teams that have got, on paper, better rosters that have made less of a footprint in this Tour de France so far. Now, I know, obviously, the eight-man teams kind of breaks things down. So if you have a dedicated GC rider who's still in the race or a dedicated sprinter, it's very hard to then also participate in all of the breakaways and be, have that kind of plan. They are liberated by the fact that they have, all right, Case Bowl is a good sprinter, and they come back behind him. But the rest of the team is really built for stages like this, clearly. And they, whatever their plan was, they had numbers up the road. And that is not easy to do, is it?
The tribute, the great tribute you can have to Mark Hirschi comes from his team itself. Here is a 21-year-old rider.
22.
Well, yes. Yeah, so,
just 22 year old rider.
Riding his first Grand Tour, and obviously the Tijs Benoots, Nicolas Roach, Nicolas Arndt, I mean, experienced riders who've been around, who've seen things, they seem to have put themselves to the service of this young guy, and he's obviously now undoubtedly the leader of the team. Even if Tijs Benoot was on paper, the team leader. I mean, Tijs Benoot had problems. He crashed. So probably he's not riding at his very best. But he managed to find this young guy and to really do a great teamwork to set him off to win a stage at last. And the way he did it, it was frustrating for all as cycling fans to see him. Fail against Alaphilippe by lack of experience, to fail against the GC contenders going back for a stage wins in the Pyrenees. And the way he did it today, his timing was already very good, in the previous stages, but it was a little bit lacking. But as you said, this time when he went, we knew it was, it was the right move.
I actually thought he'd gone a little bit too early. But there was a sort of disorganization behind, someone like Alaphilippe who counterattacked behind and got into that chasing group behind Marc Soler and Max Schachmann. Alaphilippe's presence there almost
brought disharmony on, doesn't to that, it? Yeah,
that,
yeah.
that group. I mean, had he not been there, that group might have committed more to the chase.
Once again, what we saw from Magrashi on the three times he attacked is consistency. I mean, it's always very, very tough to take back time off Hirschi on his own, which says a lot on the power.
Yeah.
His power, his boldness. I mean, he's trying again, and there he is. I mean, it was a little bit strange because on French TV, one of their reporters, Encourager, bluntly asked him the question: do you think you can win a Grand Tour one day? He's on his first Tour, the Grand Tour, and he didn't say no. You could see he was a little bit surprised by the question, but he belongs to that generation of guys like Wood van Aert is another one, and you really don't know Mathieu van der Poel and
Pogacar,
Remco Evenepoel, these guys coming up, and we really don't know what kind of potential is there, because they climb well, they sprint well, they time trial well. There's a new spontaneous generation of all rounders. It's kind of exciting.
I'd love to see a Tour de l'Avenir with the World Tour riders in it. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, just put them all against one another.
It
the under
like
24s or 25s.
I was interviewing Tijs Benoot, who was then a kind of, at 22, I think he finished fifth at Tour of Flanders. And, his team, Lotto at the time, were saying there's no limits to what this guy is capable of. And already, he's. So there are no guarantees at all. And you don't know. Tijs Benoot has kind of fallen into this trap of a little bit of trying to do everything. And I think you're better if you can identify one thing that you want to do. And, I mean, he's only 22, but Mark Hirschi has come here to try and win a stage, and he's had three goes, and he's won one. Shall we hear from the Team Sunweb race coach, Matt Winston? Here's his analysis of today's stage.
Yeah, I think it was a really good performance today by the whole team. We wanted to make it hard on the third category climb, and Søren and Tijs did a brilliant job. After some great positioning by our sprint guys, and went in a position where they could attack on the climb. Mark then followed across. We had three guys in a group of six. We knew then it would be pretty tough on the second category climb, so Mark made his move there. And then Nico Roach and Søren were in the group of chasers. And they did a fantastic job of just blocking behind and just riding in the group, not letting anybody else jump across to Mark. And Mark was able to solo to the finish, so it was a super team effort. And after all our hard work in the stages before, it's a really nice victory.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
The next generation Watt Bike Atom is the sponsor of our Tour de France coverage this year. Everyone has their favourite app for indoor training. Personally, I like to mix up a bit, keep it interesting, and because the different apps offer different types of sessions. But Lionel, do you have a favourite?
Very difficult to say whether I have a favourite. I split them into riding entertainment and then kind of suffering, really. Then you can do a bit of both but you can do some suffering on Zwift or RGT, as well as the sort of diversion of riding in virtual worlds, of course. But then the more hardcore apps like the Trainer Road, or I've had a little go on Training Peaks in the past, and the Sufferfest, I suppose, transcends both of those kind of you know, the entertainment factor as well as the physical hard work. I mean, they're all hard work, aren't they, if you're doing it properly? It's not supposed to just be a poodle, a virtual poodle, is it? I suppose the thing that I like about the What Bike Atom is that once I kind of set it all up, I could use whichever app took my fancy on any given day. So if I just wanted to do a nice coffee ride around Watopia on Zwift, I could. Or if I wanted to sort of, you know, try and improve myself physically on Trainer Road, I'd pick one of those sessions instead.
Well, I can imagine you switching mid-ride, Lionel. I can imagine you doing that. You strike me as the sort of person who might set off doing one type of ride and then change your mind after a few minutes.
Yeah, what, setting out aiming to do a really hard session and then turning it into quite a comfortable poodle. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're probably right there, Rich. You know, my willpower is the one part of my armory that needs some work. But I will say that one advantage of the What Bike Atom is that if you do set out to do a hard interval session, you can just let the bike do all the decision making for you and just let it change the resistance. So all you have to do is think about the pedaling.
Well, if you'd like to suffer or not suffer alongside Lionel, the What Bike Atom is available now from £90 per month. Go to whatbike.com. That's whatbike.com.
Yes, it's called MIQUEBK. When are they going to finish this, John?
Well, I think the secret here is that they might have finished it in the past, and then the roof fell in. It's the Notre-Dame du Bon Secours Chapel. It was built back in 1868 through to 1871 by a man called Father Louis Joyeux. And at the top of Mont Gargan is where it sits. It's a beautiful chapel, sitting out looking over the river plain here. At this point, I think I must also turn around and mention the fact that the cycling podcast François Thomazou is one of the men responsible for writing the wonderful the volume that is the Tour de France history route, all explained, and it's all of his sort of words that have been translated probably by him, because he has extraordinarily good English, that I tend to turn to at moments when we see these little things along the way, and I think a little doff of a cap to him is probably necessary as we adjust over halfway through the tour, because without him it would take an extraordinarily more research on my part than just being able to read through these notes every evening.
We're all doffing our caps, aren't we, Lionel? We doff our caps to Francois every day.
We do. How nice of Jono to give us give us
thanks.
Give Francois a nod of recognition there.
Francois, you're famous across the Eurosport viewing public now. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it's I like to be the man in the shadows, you know. It's an obscure job, like being a domestique in a team, and I like this job better than being in the spotlight, I guess.
Yeah, Jono, don't mention him again, all right?
No, that's bullshit. I'm so proud and happy.
He can barely get his head in the back of the Skoda.
Oh, his big head will be sticking out of the nest. We need to gather some more twigs and leaves.
Open the sunroof. Well, that was us travelling to Clermont-Ferrand earlier in the car, watching Eurosport.
Well, hang on. I mean, you were in the passenger seat watching.
I was watching.
And we had the audio coming through the car. I was driving, not watching. I was just listening to the commentary on Eurosport.
And I was sleeping at the back.
And you were sleeping in your nest. And what should happen? But Jonathan Harris-Bass, give you a mention, Francois. It was a great moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was my moment of glory on the Eurosport's English speaking channels. Very nice, and I'm glad, you know, to get that kind
all
of
all that work has paid off.
Yeah, all, to all, kind all of recognition. But once again,
Just, I have a question actually, Francois, because you write the Guide Touristique, which is basically plotting the way around the Tour de France route, pointing out the various things of interest, the chateau and the vineyards and places of historical interest. But how does that work? Do ASO, the race organisers, give you a list of places to talk about, or do you get sight of the route months in advance?
I must confess, I know the Tour de France route like very often 1 month before you guys. So I started working on the stage finishes and the stage starts, before everything. So and I usually get that out of the way before Christmas when the tour is announced in October, and then gradually I get the parcours of every stage, and then you've got a list of towns we're crossing, and so I actually go through the internet, through books, looking for stuff on every village we're going through. I try to keep very cycling orientated. Like I really hate to miss going through a village that's the birthplace of a Tour de France rider. I try to make sure we get that. So it's quite a bit of work, but it's also great fun to do. I learn lots of things, about Romanesque art and church architectures and castles and chateaux. I must admit that I forget, by the start of the tour, I've forgotten most of what I've written
In terms of remuneration, Francois, if we look at Panini at one end of the spectrum and the cycling podcast on the other, where does it fall?
It's reasonably well paid. I'm doing it in French and English, and there are two guys. There's the one that's on the internet, on the website that I'm doing in French and English, and then there's the commentators guy. That's the book from Jonathan has got, which is done actually in French, partly by me for the cycling aspect of things, and by a young guy who's been doing it for the first year this year, who's called Romain Francois, and he deserves a mention and a tribute as well, because he's a young and very bright young man, and he really worked hard on this year. So I'm not alone in this. I can't do everything, but and I did the English version of that.
It was very nice of Jonathan to give a little mention, because I felt a bit mean the other night, just kind of puncturing the bubble of the commentators who obviously furnish the viewers with so much information about the landscape and about the places that the Tour de France visits and passes by. I didn't want to give the impression that they're just reading it off written by Francois,
I mean, it's the work the we do with Romain and the other guys. We really give them the basis to look and they all do their homework, try to find anecdotes that are more linked to a British angle or to an Italian angle if they're Italian commentators. It's really a document. It's lots of data, and like we have in for sports events as well. You have the records, the palmarès, and everything, but then you have your own anecdotes. You have your own look on things, and sometimes I recognize when Jonathan is speaking or other guys doing the same job. Sometimes I really recognize my stuff, and sometimes I say, oh, you got something that I missed, So it's part of a whole thing.
Well, it was a nice boost for Francois today after he...
It woke him up.
It woke him up. His guide, unfortunately, he missed out the fact that we're going through Raymond Poulidor's home today, so that was nice.
Where in Clermont-Ferrand... Do you know who was the great rider from Clermont-Ferrand?
Romain Bardet.
No.
He's from Brioude.
No, he's from Brioude.
Did he live here, though?
Well, it's a big town near Brioude, so he probably
studied here.
And supports
Clermont-Ferrand Rugby Club, doesn't he?
Yeah, but the thing, of course he does, but there was a great rider, probably a guy who has been nicknamed the greatest rider never to win the tour, he's still alive. He's in 90s, I think it's 94, and I'm mentioning this guy whose name you still haven't found. He became a sports director for Jacques Anquetil and many guys. He was the most swashbuckling and picturesque riders ever. And this man, he rode a little bit like Mark Hershey. He was going for raids, attacking from afar.
Gem.
Absolutely. Raphaël Geminiani. yeah, is a legend here.
And he's from here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's he is still around, isn't he? I think James Start went to see him fairly recently.
Yeah, he's in a pensioner's home now, but still alive. And well, I wouldn't say kicking because you know he's getting old. But he's, until late in his life, he always came back to the Tour de France. He's the you know, he actually ran restaurants and discos in Clermont-Ferrand after his career. He's the archetypal bon vivant, great character. Le Grand Fusil was called the big rifle, and another nickname.
Well, a great character.
Just on Raphael Geminiani, because obviously he was Italian. Well, his family was an Italian immigrant, but his team was San Rafael. Mm-hmm. Do you know the story of that?
Saint-Raphaël was just it's just by chance. Saint-Raphaël is the name of an aperitif, you know.
It's just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's just a coincidence. Saint-Raphaël is a town in the south of France, near in the French Riviera, and you've got an old school fashionable in the 60s aperitif called Saint-Raphaël. I think it was made with orange and lemon stuff, you know.
But am I right in thinking that the San Rafael jersey just said Rafa on the front?
Yeah.
Which inspired our former sponsors, Rafa.
Absolutely, there's a bit of everything into everything, isn't it? But there you are. No, the comparison between the Urshi, I think, and Jem, in the way they rode is quite valid, you know. It's, trying again, and sometimes, you know, well, the big rifle, he was shooting lots, sometimes hitting the targets and sometimes missing out. So it's kind of a summary of what Urshi's temperament is.
Everything I've read about him suggests a very charismatic, kind of outspoken, quite bombastic character. Listen, this morning in the Place Raymond Poulidor, the square in
Chauvigny,
I met Dave Brailsford. They've had an interesting time. One of their staff members tested positive for COVID and obviously sent home. They're still waiting on results of a second test. And they've got Egan Bernal still very much in the race, but having lost some of his hair, having tried to cut his own hair the other day. anyway, I spoke to Dave Brailsford in the start town this morning. The test on the team, that must have come as a bit of a shock, did it?
A little bit unexpected, I'm not going to lie. But on the other hand, it's such a difficult environment to operate in. You know, we're doing our best. We've got our bubble. And we're very, very... You know, we've got a member of staff who just goes shopping and doesn't come in, so nobody goes out into the public, as it were. That's what we thought. We've got an extra chef, so nobody's going into the camp, you know, into the restaurants in hotels, because we think when everybody sits down to eat, they take the mask off, obviously, sit close together, members of the public. And, of course, we're in hotels where we've got no control, so there are other members of the public in the hotels that we're in, which is a challenge for us. So we decided not to use the restaurants and just have another chef, and we all eat outside as a group. We've got a group that obviously goes forward, that you've got to go into the hotel to set it up in the first place. So we've got a team that does that and goes in and gets the room, sanitises all the rooms, and they're kind of at risk, really. But we've tried very, very hard. So it's a question then of, making sure we stay vigilant now. And of course, we haven't had the second test, actually. We had a bit of a delay on the repeat test, so for all we know, it might be we've had some false positives in the past, so it could be another false positive, you know.
We learned today that the button will be reset, as it were, so the two-test rule is only per week, so the next round of tests, you'll be starting with a blank slate. Is that in line with what you thought was going to happen anyway?
Well, if I'm honest, look, what I'm seeing in the world in a minute is an evolving situation where people are adapting. So you just see, you know, in Britain, they just started out with their six people, you know, so they've adapted quickly. And they've adapted, so they're adapting to the situation and then they're adapting the rules. So to stick to a set of rules from the start that you thought was a good idea, but as you're going through and you're learning and adapting, it doesn't make sense to not adapt the rules. You know, at the end of the day, it feels to me that the most important thing is to try and keep everybody healthy and safe and make sure that if you do have somebody who's infected, then we, in my opinion, we should be testing straight away. The perfect scenario would be to test everybody every day. Then if everybody's negative, negative, and somebody gets positive, you get it straight away, you take them out of the bubble before they're infectious, and then you make it all, you know, make it safe for everybody. And that way, everybody tries to get to Paris, everybody's looking after the race, everybody's looking after individuals, and I'd be all in for doing that personally. So I think the seven-day thing's a bit random, if I'm honest. It's just an arbitrary rule. It doesn't necessarily make that much sense, but I get it.
Mm. How about the race? How do you feel that's shaping up for me?
I think the race is really good, actually. I think it's intriguing, isn't it? You know, I think it's... you know, we're kind of coming into this four-day block now. Between now and the rest day is a very, very telling, very important strategic part of the race. When you put those 4 days together, obviously today is going to be, it's a long day, it's going to be, you know, quite a long, you know, hard day, solid day. Tomorrow's probably one of the biggest days of the race, really, really hard day. Then we go up to Inter-Lyon, and then we've got another hilltop finish, you know, before the rest day. And I think that's really going to see the start of the accumulation of fatigue. And then we go into that final week then. And I think it's on a who's coming up, who's staying the same, and who's going down, so fatigue and fitness-wise. And I think that will determine the final event, final result.
I have to ask you about Bernal's haircut.
Yeah. Nothing to do with me, I think. You know, I thought if he'd have gone the whole hog and shaved it all off, I'd have been a big fan of that one. But
Not too late.
No, bit of DIY, to be fair. But he's a funny guy, you know, he's a character. I like him a lot. He's such a character. And he just came out, said, OK, I've had a go. And he said he was doing like a number two on the side and took the thing off, so it was like nothing. And he forgot. Tried to correct a little bit, and then realised he'd shaved it all off, and then he said I had to do the whole lot, and he was laughing about it, you know. He's a lovely guy, really, as a character. So quite funny, really.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off at scienceandsport.com with the code
CISCP25.
Oh, don't SIS. Oh, SISCP25.
I don't know. It's, you know,
one day.
I say thanks very much indeed, especially for Martin van Grumberen of Sporza, who we met at the start this morning. He obviously listens to the podcast. Hi, Martin. Thanks for listening.
And Sports are the Belgian TV national station that cover the Tour de France, yeah, and all the big races, yeah.
Yes, indeed. And they're here in numbers as they are at all bike races. And Martin was asking what indeed means in that context. Mm. Thanks very much, indeed. And it means different things, doesn't it? But got me thinking about it. Thanks very much indeed to Science and Sport. Thanks very much indeed to Martin for listening.
He was also drilling away at, you know, Francois, and we were wondering whether Sports were going to poach Francois.
It was the second time today that Francois has been bigged up by, you know, Eurosport and Martin, both very complimentary about Francois and his grasp of English and other things. I mean, not so much his grasp of the SIS code, but never mind. It's a small detail. Well, we heard from Dave Brailsford before the break there, and he said that tomorrow's stage he thinks will be a really, really important one. It's not one that people have really been speaking about an awful lot, but it's one of these potential banana skins, isn't it, for the GC riders, and a very hard one for them to tackle and approach. I mean, we saw a few years ago in this neck of the woods, Chris Froome had some problems on that day, and the roads are narrow and twisty, and you know, you can be in a situation where the team car's stuck behind and you're left isolated and unsupported. We've heard over the years many times riders said that stages in the Massif Central turn out to be the hardest stages of the entire tour. And I think that's even more the case now when the race is not just sort of sprint teams and GC teams. Teams like Sunweb or Bora Hansgrohe or CCC, you know, teams with ambitions to just win the stage can make it really, really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the key to it, isn't it? It's Puy-Marie or the Pas de Perol is its other name. I'm not quite sure why it has two names, but
Actually, the Puy-Marie is the name of the summit, and then the Pas de Perol is the pass, the mountain pass that gets to it, and you've got several little roads going there. So meaning that actually we've already been with the Tour de France very close to Puy-Marie, but we've never been to the very top. And the very top is Puy-Marie, the summit, and then we've got Pas de Perol and another little climb that the tour has already been through.
Yeah, normally it's a pass on the way to Aurillac or Saint-Flour, right. Mm-hmm. Or most recently Le Lioran, where Greg Van Avermaet won a few years ago. As you say, Rich, I think that's a really interesting point. I think that's what contributed to today being as open and as exciting as it was, because the GC is far from settled, and so you just don't know what will happen. And it's becoming a bit of a modern tour cliche, but I always think of this as ambush territory. You could imagine something peculiar happening, Bernal being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or Roglic being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the opposing team absolutely drilling it to try and really make gains, because the roads approaching are hard, but it's not like mountain passes. It's real eyeballs out racing territory, rather than that kind of steady 40-50 minute measured effort of climbing a mountain. And again, because the descents and the flat roads are so twisty and not really flat, it makes it very hard to recover time. There's not that kind of lull in the valley road that you get in the Alps particularly, but also in the Pyrenees. And so I understand why teams might be a bit nervous ahead of tomorrow, especially when, if something amazing happens on the approach, the climb gives the opportunity for somebody to really press home an advantage. So it's the first real unmissable stage of the tour, I think, tomorrow.
Yeah, the Massif Central is sometimes looked down upon, like not being real mountains, like being all mountains, kind of. But everybody who's been riding a bike or trekking in the Massif Central, in terms of the landscapes, it reminds me a lot of the Lake District, you know. And the Lake District is about the same. I mean, the heights of the hills are not, you know, Scaffold Pike or whichever. They don't look very hard. But when you have to get up those mountains, or if you ride in the Lake District, you realize pretty soon it's harder than it looks on paper. And the Massif Central is pretty close to them in terms of what it looks like and in terms of the difficulty of the roads.
The Lake District on steroids. It just feels on a bigger scale, doesn't it?
It is like that.
And it's far more remote, rugged. There aren't many people, there aren't many houses, but it's absolutely beautiful.
And also, it's pretty warm as well. I don't know whether it's what it's normally like in mid-September. I mean, but it felt quite hot. I mean,
it's not hot, is it?
It's not hot, but 30 degrees.
Pretty warm.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, listen, shall we wrap things up for tonight? As you say, Lionel, an unmissable stage tomorrow. Really looking forward to it. I love stages like that. Before we go, we should say thanks to some friends of the podcast. Thanks to everybody who signed up as a friend of the podcast. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £15 to access all our exclusive episodes.
The next one will be your chat, Richard, with Ola Shenoui, who of course is part of Eurosport and GCN's coverage at the moment, co-host of the Cycling Podcast.
The life story
of course.
Ola Shenoui, absolutely.
Also unmissable.
Unmissable. actually, before we do the thanks to friends of the podcast, quick mention for our Kilometre Zero series supported by Zwift. Today's was an interview with Chris Thompson, historian, author of the Tour de France, A Cultural History of the Tour de France, an amazing book. Some of you clearly, you know, those who've read it absolutely love it, and there are a few of you out there. It's an amazingly detailed, rich book. I thoroughly recommend it, and hopefully it's a really interesting conversation with Chris Thompson in our latest episode. That's Thursday's episode of Kilometre Zero. Fridays will be another installment of the Rider Diaries, and there's more great stuff from them, including Sam Bewley, who had to, unfortunately, pack the other day. So we'll hear a final installment from Sam. From me, a big thank you to the following friends of the podcast: Robert Healy, Stephen Quinn, Andrew Long, Samuel Lowe, Michael Robbins, and Matthew Nugent.
And a big thank you from me to Mr. L. Tulip. I love the formal ones.
Thanks, Mr. Lionel Burden.
Alan McGill, Thibault Jarlagon, Jonathan Townend, Lars Brendler, and Mr. J.W. Oakins.
Un grand merci to Edwin Mackey, Claire Burns, James Dale, Isaac Stoll, Lawrence de la Meilleure, and Peter Singlehurst.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you. And can I, you know, ghost track now, because we're crossing that. My story about
Jack
Shearer.
Yeah, of course. Oh, I almost forgot.
The okay, so story, so yeah. It'll be like it was Chomé Les Monédières. I think it was 1988 or 1989. I always get it wrong. I think 88 maybe. It was a Tour de France stage won by Martial Gagnon. Chomé Les Monédières is about 7 or 8 km away from Saran, so in the same area. And when I got there for the stage finish, I was starving, you know, from sometimes it happens. I mean, Lionel knows what I'm talking about. And I noticed, you know, by sneaking out of the press room, that there was a great buffet, you know, on the sort of a cloister. And it was a huge buffet with lots of stuff, pâté, sausage, lots of vegetables, you know, little tomatoes, lots of stuff. And I decided that, you know, I would, it was not open, obviously, but I decided that I was too hungry. So I was alone in that cloister. You know, and I went to the buffet and starting to you know, kind of nick you know, pieces of pâté, pieces of petit four, pieces of everything, and cheese. And while I was doing that, all of a sudden, a kind of huge shadow came lurking over my shoulder, and I saw this arm coming to, you know, take a little piece of pâté and sausage above my shoulder, and I looked back. And there was this face, really, you know, looking at me that I'd seen before in my life. And it was Jacques Chirac. He was prime minister at the time. And I was really surprised. And he looked at me and said, he didn't know me. He said, have you got a fag? And at the time, I was smoking. So I gave him a fag. He lit his fag on, you know, from my fag and said, oh, great, the same as mine. And off he went. So that was my first, and you know, I had other encounters, but among crowds with Jacques Chirac. But my first and most striking encounter on the Tour de France with a guy who was about to become French president for 2 terms. There you are.
Did you ever meet Donald Trump on the Tour de Trump?
Well, not. No, unfortunately not. But who knows?